Hello there. Today is Thursday, October 19th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, President Trump is taking heat for a call to a fallen soldier's family. Another act of gun violence. We talked to someone in a country where there is none. The Me Too campaign is not going away. And also ahead, the latest movies in U.S. theaters. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump has denied making insensitive comments to the wife of an American soldier killed in Niger, saying he has proof that a Florida lawmaker fabricated a story, saying the president told the soldier's widow that her husband knew what he signed up for.
Didn't say what that congresswoman said. Didn't say it at all. She knows it, and she now is not saying it. I did not say what she said, and I'd like her to make the statement again, because I did not say what she said. I had a very nice conversation with the woman, with the wife, who is sounded like a lovely woman.
Florida Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, who represents the district where Sergeant Johnson's family lives, said she was listening in on the call Trump made to Johnson's widow, Myesha, while family members were in a limo en route to an airport to meet the soldier's body. Speaking to MSNBC, Wilson said Trump was almost like joking during the conversation, which was on speaker in the car.
This man is a sick man. He's cold-hearted, and he feels no pity or sympathy for anyone. This is a grieving widow who is 6 months pregnant.
Sergeant LaDavid Johnson was among four U.S. soldiers killed 2 weeks ago near the Niger-Mali border in an ambush that U.S. officials believe was carried out by ISIS-affiliated fighters. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A med student close to fulfilling her dream is among the dead in the Somalia blast. Trump and the Puerto Rico governor will meet at the White House. The U.S. Attorney General is grilled on Trump, the Russia probe, and immigration. And a study finds teens overwhelmingly prefer Snapchat to Facebook. This is International Edition. A man with a lengthy criminal past who showed up for work at a countertop company in Maryland on Wednesday and shot five of his coworkers has been arrested. Three of those people were killed, two critically wounded. It's the latest gun-related violence following the massacre in Las Vegas that killed 58 people. And while that triggered many to call for stricter gun laws in the United States, most believe that will not happen. Joining me now is Clive Williams, professor of criminology at Australia National University, where gun violence is rare in Australia ever since an incident prompted a major change in gun laws in that country. Thank you for being with us. Tell us about that incident.
Well, it took place in Tasmania in 1996, and it was a mentally disturbed person named Martin Bryant. It was an active shooter attack which killed 35 people at a place called Port Arthur, which was an old prison settlement in Tasmania. It was in a relatively remote location, so he had the place to himself pretty much without any prospect of anyone being able to retaliate him.
Because of that, it would appear that gun control laws changed dramatically after that incident.
That's right. The government levied a tax on people to pay for a gun buyback scheme, and that led to the recovery and destruction of 661,000 weapons, roughly, and which obviously took most of the weapons out of private hands in Australia. So it made it a lot more difficult for anyone that had an interest in using a firearm for homicide or whatever to actually get hold of one. So subsequently to that, there was another amnesty back in 2003, and then there was an amnesty again this year to take some more weapons out, because there's always been a bit of a grey market where people like farmers and others have kept weapons hidden, not wanted to hand them in.
Mm-hmm.
But the penalties are such that it's now probably most people would say it's not worth risking, because the penalties are a fine of, say, $140,000, I think is the maximum. But
the main concern is
that you can go to jail for 5 years for having an unlicensed firearm. So it obviously is going to focus people's attention on having weapons hidden away.
Is it as easy as it in Australia as it is in the United States to get a firearm license?
No, it's not very easy at all. In fact, years ago, I was quite interested in getting an ex-military pistol of the kind that I had when I was in the military. And I just didn't bother eventually, because I would have had to keep it at gun club. I wouldn't have been allowed to have it at home. It would have been in a locked safe in a gun club. And so I'd only have been able to use it when I actually went to the gun club. So my interest was more in it as an antique item, or, you know, sort of just a desirable possession. It wasn't really that I wanted to be shooting it all the time, so I just didn't persevere with that. But that was before the gun buyback scheme. So even back then, it was very hard to get hold of pistols. And long firearms like rifles and that sort of thing, farmers have had those in the past for, you know, keeping down foxes and kangaroos and so on. But now it's much more difficult even for farmers to be able to get hold of a firearm.
What do you believe it would take to change, get stricter gun laws in the United States? Because obviously the killings aren't stopping.
No, that's right. And it's also, it's to do with culture, I think, as well. I mean, I've lived in the U.S. on several occasions, and I think the U.S. has a different attitude towards many of these sort of issues. And, for example, hunting in America is regarded as an acceptable thing, whereas in Australia people would look sideways at you if you said you went out hunting. And firearms possession would be the same thing. You know, people would sort of think you're a bit odd if you wanted to have a firearm, I think, these days. So it's a different attitude. And also I noticed that, you know, gun ownership in America is, at the moment, for every 100 people, there's 112 firearms. In Australia, there's 22 firearms per 100 people. But the interesting thing is that there's 10 more times likelihood that a firearm in America will be used in a homicide than there is in Australia. So there is a different, obviously, level of aggression, maybe, or a different attitude. Maybe people feel more defensive or so. But there's more likelihood in America of people resorting to firearms, either to protect themselves or to take it out on other people. And, of course, there's quite a high level in the U.S. of unintentional homicides with children playing with firearms, that sort of thing. It's a very difficult one because, you know, like with the situation in Tasmania, the U.S. reaction would have been, well, if somebody at the site had had a firearm,
mm-hmm.
they might have been able to take out Martin Bryant before he killed 35 people.
Right.
You know, because it took maybe half an hour or so for the police to get there.
Right.
But, you know, that would be more likely the American reaction.
Being in Australia and with the low number of gun casualties that occur in comparison to what people are seeing happening here, how do Australians view the U.S. in terms of guns? What is the overall opinion there?
I guess that, you know, it's a bit like U.K. and other places. I was in the U.K. when the shooting occurred in Las Vegas, and you know, as in Australia, people roll their eyes and think, well, you know, how could this possibly happen? You know, it's it should be obvious to people that having more guns is going to be a problem. And but it never seems to be that kind of reaction. I think that Obama had that sort of reaction to the shooting at Sandy Hook. And maybe most Americans did too, but, you know, they feel sort of unempowered to do anything much about it. And I think that's a sad thing, really. But the rest of the world sort of looks on and says, well, you know, I can't believe this is happening in the United States.
All right. Well, thank you for your perspective, Clive Williams, professor of criminology at Australia National University. Well, in the past 48 hours, thousands of women have taken to Twitter and Facebook, sharing their personal stories of sexual harassment and assault under the hashtag MeToo. The social media rallying cry comes in the wake of numerous allegations of sexual misconduct by Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein. And this latest social media movement has sparked a global conversation about women and men, among women and men about sexual harassment and assault. Joining me now to talk more about it is Jane Ward, author and professor of gender and sexuality studies at the University of California, Riverside. Thank you for being with us. So do you think that this is just another topic of the day that'll pass, or will it actually have the potential to bring about change?
Well, I certainly hope that it is not the topic du jour. I think with this issue, and really what we're talking about is the issue of rape culture, meaning that sexual assault is just so remarkably, horrifically ubiquitous. It's just part of most girls' and women's lives. And so you really talk to most any woman, and she'll have a story, starting in her childhood, of walking down the street and men who were flashing her, you know, being flashed. That's something that comes up a lot for young girls, or just being harassed on the street, comments made about their bodies, this kind of thing. And so I think the fact that we are raising people's consciousness in general about how profoundly common this is, and what a formative experience it is in girls' lives, for young girls and then on up into adulthood, and how deeply it shapes women's understanding of their sexuality, how they need to protect themselves, whether men are safe or not, who's in charge of sex and sexuality, all of this. And so the more that we can open men's eyes in particular, so they can start reflecting on whether this is the kind of world they want to live in, the better.
Exactly. So, I mean, and it's great that something that really isn't very pleasant to hear about Harvey Weinstein and the women that have come out saying the things that he did, but that something positive has been taking shape here because of this. I mean, we're talking about the article I was just looking at. We're witnessing 13 million stories being shared here. These are people that are no longer, they're feeling brave enough to not be silent anymore.
And you know what's been fascinating to me to witness is that often the reaction to women telling their stories in social media is that friends and family say, oh gosh, I'm so sorry this happened to you. You're so brave. And, you know, and this includes me. You know, I participated in sharing stories about sexual harassment experiences that I've had over my life. And in some way, you feel like that kind of emotional reaction of maybe sympathy, but maybe also pity, maybe also worry, it's hard to take it in because for most women, I think, we've just normalized this experience. So it's like, oh, well, thank you very much for feeling sorry for me. But this happened when I was 9, and then it happened again when I was 12, and then it happened again. So I've had to make peace with the fact that this is just part of being a woman in the United States and often around the globe, though it takes different forms globally. So I think we're still figuring out as a culture, how do you even respond to a story like this? You know, I don't think sympathy is really what people want. I think what women want at this point is like, stop doing it. Don't tell me you're sorry.
Right. It's not like you're not giving someone condolences for someone that died. You want them to say, okay, we need to do something to make change. We need to bring about change.
Exactly. Right.
You know, I wrote Me Too. I didn't share any stories, but I've thought about and more keep coming into mind. It's amazing that every woman you talk to really has a story. And I just wonder, how do we keep the momentum going, though? Do you think we've opened something up that won't get just pushed aside anymore?
Well, absolutely. I don't think this is the beginning. In fact, I know it is not the beginning of a conversation. This is a conversation that has been happening for not just decades, but centuries among women activists and leaders in this country who have drawn attention to the conditions of sexual violence that so many women face. And then things happen that are kind of cultural flashpoints that bring the issue up to the surface again in a much broader way. And that momentum may not be sustainable, but certainly I think those of us who do this kind of work, think about these issues, are involved in organizations that do this work, now have another cultural reference point that we can use as we're educating people about the severity of this problem. So, you know, we can mention Harvey Weinstein's name and people will say now, oh yes, I know what you mean. I understand how this is something that can happen repeatedly over a number of years and be covered up by an entire team of people. Right. I understand now that it's not just about, you know, toxic masculinity, but it's about wealth and power and the way that intersects with masculinity. It's an important moment. It's probably not going to stay on the national radar. And yet that doesn't mean that we haven't moved forward.
Right. And, you know, the hashtag may fall to the wayside. wayside with the, another news story of the day, but according to the article that I'm referring to, it says, but the bell cannot be unrung. I loved that line.
Yes. And, you know, there's just no way. I just don't believe, and I don't think I'll ever believe, that we all want to live in a world like this, in which girls are and women are so commonly manipulated, coerced, or forced into sex. I just don't think the vast majority of people want that world. So the reason it's still happening is in part because people are in denial about it, or they don't know what to do about it. And so the more we intervene in that denial or that confusion about how to address it, the better it is.
All right. Well, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Jane Ward is an author and professor of gender and sexuality studies at the University of California, Riverside. And turning now to what's trending on social media, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, Lori, if there's one thing that's for certain on social media, it is that crime does not pay.
Okay.
And we have two instances where that is the case today. First instance involves the sexual harassment and sexual abuse allegations that have been swirling for the past few weeks against producer Harvey Weinstein. Actress Rose McGowan had her Twitter account suspended after she spoke out against Weinstein and against actor Ben Affleck, who she accused of covering up Weinstein's abuses. Mm-hmm. Twitter suspended her account, and it caused this outroar where a number of women issued a 24-hour boycott of Twitter. They said they weren't going to use the social network because they said McGowan should not have been blocked. It should be these sexual harassment people. It should be the people who are using this kind of awful language, violent language against women, against all people. Well, that message was heard loud and clear by Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey. And last week, he vowed that there were going to be changes to Twitter's policies to fight those behaviors. Well, now we're getting a glimpse at what those specific policy changes are. Twitter is going to immediately and permanently suspend any account that it identifies as being poster of non-consensual nudity. Previously, it was just they just suspended the account temporarily. Now they're blocking those people totally. They're going to allow bystanders to report sexual harassment on Twitter. Previously, it was only the people who were being harassed to put the onus on the victim. Now anyone can report this. And they're also going to take action against violent imagery, hate speech, violent groups, and any tweets that glorify violence. Twitter said in an email that they hope these changes show how serious they are about thinking about their rules and how quickly they're moving to update their policies and enforce them. So for people who are doing things that are criminal or behaviors that are not appropriate on social media, they are going to face those ramifications, at least on Twitter.
All right. Anything else worth talking about today?
Yes. This is kind of a fun story. The crime doesn't pay, as we said, and especially it doesn't pay when you taunt the police. A gentleman in the U.S. state of Michigan posted on Facebook that he was not worried that this police department in his hometown was looking for him because he's had these outstanding warrants. He said, he said, if your next post gets 1,000 shares, I'll turn myself in with a dozen donuts. You can guess where this went, Lori.
Okay.
The post got more than 1,000 shares. Mm-hmm. And amazingly, true to his word, this gentleman turned himself in with a dozen donuts to the police. So he was arrested and he was put in jail for 30 days, but he lived up to his word on social media. And so this police department in Michigan wrote that he turned himself in, and they wanted to express their gratitude for all the people who followed and shared that post because it helped to achieve a level of justice. So as we said, crime does not pay on social media, especially if you taunt the police. Then you got to live up to your post, bring in the donuts, and put yourself before the law.
Sounds pretty tasty. I think I'm hungry now.
I'm hungry too. Hungry for justice.
All right. Thanks, Andrew.
Thanks, Lori.
All right. And you can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
VOA News.
VOA. When news breaks, VOA News is there. Around the clock, listen to VOA Newscast at the top of each hour, along with our detailed news programs and analysis.
We are online at voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
VOA. VOA's International Edition continues as we turn to the latest movies in U.S. theaters. And for that, we're joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. I know Only the Brave is based on a true story of those amazing firemen that rushed in to battle a wildfire and unfortunately lost their lives, 19 of them. That was quite a tragedy. It was only a couple of years ago, and now there's a movie about it. And you saw it?
Yeah, it happened in 2013, yeah, so it's very recent. They were called the Granite Mountain Hotshots. And these guys, you know, California is burning right now. So when you see this, you just kind of think, oh, it's just a regular fireman. No, these are highly trained firefighters that are put in such harm's way. And when you're watching this movie, I mean, you can choke on the smoke coming off the screen. You can feel the heat because these fires move so fast, especially these guys are fighting in Arizona. So it's an arid, dry conditions where these things happen so fast that they're available 24/7. So the highlight of the movie, or the main point of the movie, is when they go to Yarnell, Arizona. They're trying to prevent the fire from burning these towns up, and it's about there's 20 of them and one survivor, and it's just about not only them fighting fires, but you get to know these guys. That's what makes it even more traumatic and painful. Josh Brolin is like leading the gang of the hotshots, and also Miles Teller, who was the only survivor in the movie, he plays the guy that, you know, is coming off drugs. He's as a new form dad trying to reestablish connections with his girlfriend. So he's turning to being a fireman to get discipline, to get friendship, to get through these tough times. So the movie is just, you know, it's funny because I don't know if I'm spoiling the movie because, you know, we know the story.
Right.
I went with a friend last night who didn't know it.
Oh, okay.
And a critic turned and told him the ending. It was, isn't this a shame about the 19 men perishing in the fire? Mm-hmm. And he got upset because, you know, if you don't know the story of this.
Yeah. So, well, I think most people do, though, probably.
I think so, too. But it's much more than just, you know, as the movie gets along, you just kind of start, you know, clutching your chest. And but it's just amazing performances from Miles Teller, Josh Brolin, Jeff Bridges also, and just Jennifer Connelly, all-star cast. And, you know, we always say, you know, thank a veteran, and which I do every time I see one. But the next time I see a firefighter, especially with, you know, the tragedy here in Las Vegas that we've had recently, you know, it's just the firemen, the first responders, all these guys are heroes. But
they are.
This is a story of some really amazing men that prevented a whole town from perishing.
Awesome. Well, we'll definitely have to check that one out. And then you've got a little bit of a lighter one, the Florida Project. That sounds pretty fun.
It's not.
Oh, okay.
it sounds fun, but it's not. It's based on these people that live in these motels in Orlando, you know, outside the outskirts of all the tourist areas, you know, these rundown motels.
Right, Disney World?
It's almost, outside of Disney World and Universal Studios. And it's about the story of a mother and her 7-year-old who are trying to survive in these hotels, trying to find jobs, and there's drugs, and there's all kinds of danger around, and Willem Dafoe plays the caretaker of the motel that kind of looks after everybody. And the movie is shot by Sean Baker, the director, who gives it like a cinema verite. So there's really no story. It's just a vignette of these kids and trying to survive in these motels.
Oh, wow.
And so it's a real hard-hitting drama, and the director casts non-professionals in the movie. So there's a realism and an honesty to it. But it's about a brutal childhood. It's a brutal coming-of-age story. But it's one of my favorite films of the year. It's just an amazing experience.
Wow. All right. Thanks so much, Jeffrey K. Howard. You can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. And a British singer who's had some personal problems recently is back now with a new single, a new album, and a new tour. VOA Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with more.
Well, today I've got a wonderful singer, songwriter, and it's been a few years since we've heard of him. Sam Smith is back with his sophomore album. The last time we heard from Sam was an album called In the Lonely Hour, which came out in 2014, 3 years ago, and gave us some big hits like Lay Me Down and Stay With Me and I'm Not the Only One and Like I Can. And Sam Smith earned himself, would you believe, 4 Grammys out of the 6 he was nominated for in 2014. And that wasn't it. He won the 2015 Brit Award in England for British Breakthrough Act. At the Billboard Music Awards that year, he got 3 awards. He's mentioned twice in the Guinness Book of World Records. And Sam is now back with a brand new album. It's coming out on November 3rd. And Sam's new single, which is doing very well and debuted at number 1 in the UK, is called Too Good at Goodbyes.
I'm never gonna let you close to me, even though you mean the most to me. Cause every time I open up, it hurts. So I'm never gonna get too close to you, even when I mean the most to you, in case you go and leave me in the dirt.
Now, didn't Sam Smith perform in a James Bond movie?
In fact, he did. He actually didn't act in it, but his music appeared in a James Bond film. In fact, the big hit that he had there was called Writings on the Wall.
That's right. I remember
and that.
That
song earned him not only an Oscar for Best Original Film Song in 2015, but also it got him a Golden Globe Award as well. And the James Bond film that year was called Spectre. But since that time, Sam Smith has kind of been laying low. He decided to take a break after he released his debut album. He said, I need to make some more stories. I need some more romance in my life. He had a boyfriend at that time. They split up. Sam went into a depression and decided he didn't want to record again. He didn't want to do anything. He didn't feel he had the motivation. His team is the one that actually picked him up, got him up out of his home, and said, we're going in and we're going to make a new album. And so Sam recorded the new album, and it's coming out November 3rd, and it's called The Thrill of It All. And some of the new songs on the album include artists like Adam Lambert from American Idol. He's also got a song which was produced by Timbaland, who's quite well known in R&B music. So I'm excited to hear the new album. If the first song is any indication, it's going to be a great album from Sam Smith.
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
I'm way too good at goodbye.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can always find us online at voanews.com. Thank you so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The president, in consultation with the Secretary of State, determined the administration is unable to certify under a domestic law that the benefits Iran receives from the nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, are proportionate to the measures Iran has taken. After completing a review of U.S. policy toward Iran, President Donald Trump announced on October 13th that he cannot and will not make this certification. He also cited the Iranian regime's destabilizing activity, including support for terrorist proxies in the Middle East, its financing of terrorism around the world, and its ballistic missile program as part of the totality of concerns he has with the Iranian regime. The refusal by President Trump to make the certification under the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act of 2015 does not mean that the United States has withdrawn from the deal. It means that the administration will work closely with Congress and international partners to address what President Trump calls the JCPOA's many serious flaws.
So that the Iranian regime can never threaten the world with nuclear weapons. These include the deal's sunset clauses that in just a few years will eliminate key restrictions on Iran's nuclear program. The flaws in the deal also include insufficient enforcement and near total silence on Iran's missile programs.
Congress has already begun the work to address these problems, President Trump said.
As we have seen in North Korea, the longer we ignore a threat, the worse that threat becomes. It is why we are determined that the world's leading sponsor of terrorism will never obtain nuclear weapons.
President Trump expressed the hope that new U.S. measures directed at the Iranian regime, including new sanctions against Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps pursuant to a counterterrorism authority, will compel Iran to reevaluate its pursuit of terror. at the expense of its people, and will help bring about a future of peace, stability, and prosperity in the Middle East.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.